The Preserving Machine, read by G. Valmont Thomas. Doc Labyrinth leaned back in his lawn chair, closing his eyes gloomily. He pulled his blanket up around his knees. "Well?" I said. I was standing by the barbecue pit, warming my hands. It was a clear, cold day. The sunny Los Angeles sky was almost cloud-free. Beyond Labyrinth's modest house, a gently undulating expanse of green stretched off until it reached the mountains. A small forest that gave the illusion of wilderness within the very limits of the city. "Well?" I said. "Then the machine did work the way you expected?" Labyrinth did not answer. I turned around. The old man was staring moodily ahead, watching an enormous dun-colored beetle that was slowly climbing the side of his blanket. The beetle rose methodically, its face blank with dignity. It passed over the top and disappeared down the far side. We were alone again. Labyrinth sighed and looked up at me.
"Oh, it worked well enough."
I looked after the beetle, but it was nowhere to be seen. A faint breeze eddied around me, chill and thin in the fading afternoon twilight. I moved nearer the barbecue pit.
"Tell me about it," I said.
Dr. Labyrinth, like most people who read a great deal and who have too much time on their hands, had become convinced that our civilization was going the way of Rome. He saw, I think, the same cracks forming that had sundered the ancient world, the world of Greece and Rome, and it was his conviction that presently our world, our society, would pass away as theirs did, and a period of darkness would follow. Now Labyrinth, having thought this, began to brood over all the fine and lovely things that would be lost in the reshuffling of societies. He thought of the art, the literature, the manners, the music, everything that would be lost. And it seemed to him that of all these grand and noble things, music would probably be the most lost, the quickest forgotten. Music is the most perishable of things, fragile and delicate, easily destroyed. Labyrinth worried about this, because he loved music, because he hated the idea that someday there would be no more Brahms and Mozart. No more gentle chamber music that he could dreamily associate with powdered wigs and resin bows with long, slender candles melting away in the gloom. What a dry and unfortunate world it would be without music. How dusty and unbearable. This is how he came to think of the preserving machine. One evening, as he sat in his living room in his deep chair, the gramophone on low, a vision came to him. He perceived in his mind a strange sight. The last score of a Schubert trio. The last copy, dog-eared, well-thumbed, lying on the floor of some gutted place, probably a museum. A bomber moved overhead. Bombs fell, bursting the museum to fragments, bringing the walls down in a roar of rubble and plaster. In the debris, the last score disappeared, lost in the rubbish to rot and mold. And then, in Doc Labyrinth's vision, he saw the score come burrowing out like some buried mole, quite like a mole, in fact, with claws and sharp teeth and a furious energy. If music had that faculty, the ordinary everyday instinct of survival which every worm and mole has, how different it would be. If music could be transformed into living creatures, animals with claws and teeth, then music might survive. If only a machine could be built, a machine to process musical scores into living forms. But Doc Labyrinth was no mechanic. He made a few tentative sketches and sent them hopefully around to the research laboratories. Most of them were much too busy with war contracts, of course. But at last he found the people he wanted. A small Midwestern university was delighted with his plans, and they were happy to start work on the machine at once. Weeks passed. At last, Labyrinth received a postcard from the university. The machine was coming along fine. In fact, it was almost finished. They had given it a trial run, feeding a couple of popular songs into it. The results? Two small mouse-like animals had come scampering out, rushing around the laboratory until the cat caught and ate them. But the machine was a success. It came to him shortly after, packed carefully in a wood crate, wired together and fully insured. He was quite excited as he set to work,
taking the slats from it. Many fleeting notions must have coursed through his mind as he adjusted the controls and made ready for the first transformation. He had selected a priceless score to begin with. The score of the Mozart G minor quintet. For a time, he turned the pages, lost in thought, his mind far away. At last, he carried it to the machine and dropped it in. Time passed. Labyrinth stood before it, waiting nervously, apprehensive and not really certain what would greet him when he opened the compartment. He was doing a fine and tragic work, it seemed to him, preserving the music of the great composers for all eternity. What would his thanks be? What would he find? What form would this all take before it was over? There were many questions unanswered. The red light of the machine was glinting, even as he meditated. The process was over. The transformation had already taken place. He opened the door.
"Good Lord," he said. "This is very odd."
A bird, not an animal, stepped out. The Mozart bird was pretty, small and slender, with the flowing plumage of a peacock. It ran a little way across the room and then walked back to him, curious and friendly. Trembling, Doc Labyrinth bent down, his hand out. The Mozart bird came near. Then, all at once, it swooped up into the air.
"Amazing," he murmured.
He coaxed the bird gently, patiently, and at last it fluttered down to him. Labyrinth stroked it for a long time, thinking. What would the rest of them be like? He could not guess. He carefully gathered up the Mozart bird and put it into a box. He was even more surprised the next day when the Beethoven beetle came out, stern and dignified. That was the beetle I saw myself climbing along his red blanket, intent and withdrawn on some business of its own. After that came the Schubert animal. The Schubert animal was silly, an adolescent sheep creature that ran this way and that, foolish and wanting to play. Labyrinth sat down right then and there and did some heavy thinking. Just what were survival factors? Was a flowing plume better than claws? Better than sharp teeth? Labyrinth was stumped. He had expected an army of stout badger creatures, equipped with claws and scales, digging, fighting, ready to gnaw and kick. Was he getting the right thing? Yet who could say what was good for survival? The dinosaurs had been well-armed, but there were none of them left. In any case, the machine was built. It was too late to turn back now. Labyrinth went ahead, feeding the music of many composers into the preserving machine, one after another, until the wood behind his house was filled with creeping, bleating things that screamed and crashed in the night. There were many oddities that came out, creations that startled and astonished him. The Brahms insect had many legs sticking in all directions, a vast, platter-shaped centipede. It was low and flat, with a coating of uniform fur. The Brahms insect liked to be by itself, and it went off promptly, taking great pains to avoid the Wagner animal who had come just before. The Wagner animal was large and splashed with deep colors. It seemed to have quite a temper, and Doc Labyrinth was a little afraid of it, as were the Bach bugs, the round ball-like creatures, a whole flock of them, some large, some small, that had been obtained for the 48 preludes and fugues. And there was the Stravinsky bird, made up of curious fragments and bits and many others besides. So he let them go, off into the woods, and away they went, hopping and rolling and jumping as best they could. But already a sense of failure hung over him. Each time a creature came out, he was astonished. He did not seem to have control over the results at all. It was out of his hands, subject to some strong, invisible law that had subtly taken over, and this worried him greatly. The creatures were bending, changing before a deep, impersonal force, a force that Labyrinth could neither see nor understand, and it made him afraid. Labyrinth stopped talking. I waited for a while, but he did not seem to be going on. I looked around at him. The old man was staring at me in a strange, plaintive way.
"I don't really know much more," he said. I haven't been back there for a long time, back in the woods. I'm afraid to. I know something is going on, but...
Why don't we both go and take a look?
He smiled with relief.
You wouldn't mind, would you? I was hoping you might suggest that. This business is beginning to get me down.
He pushed his blanket aside and stood up, brushing himself off.
Let's go, then.
We walked around the side of the house and along a narrow path into the woods. Everything was wild and chaotic, overgrown and matted, an unkempt, unattended sea of green. Doc Labyrinth went first, pushing the branches off the path, stooping and wriggling to get through. Quite a place, I observed. We made our way for a time. The woods were dark and damp. It was almost sunset now, and a light mist was descending on us, drifting down through the leaves above.
No one comes here.
The doc stopped suddenly, looking around.
Maybe we'd better go and find my gun. I don't want anything to happen.
You seem certain that things have got out of hand. I came up beside him and we stood together. Maybe it's not as bad as you think. Labyrinth looked around. He pushed some shrubbery back with his foot.
They're all around us. Everywhere. Watching us. Can't you feel it?
I nodded absently. What's this? I lifted up a heavy moldering branch, particles of fungus breaking from it. I pushed it out of the way. A mound lay outstretched, shapeless and indistinct, half buried in the soft ground. What is it? I said again. Labyrinth stared down, his face tight and forlorn. He began to kick at the mound aimlessly. I felt uncomfortable.
What is it, for heaven's sake? I said. Do you know?
Labyrinth looked slowly up at me.
It's the Schubert animal, he murmured. Or it was, once. There isn't much left of it anymore.
The Schubert animal. That was the one that had run and leaped like a puppy, silly and wanting to play. I bent down, staring at the mound, pushing a few leaves and twigs from it. It was dead, all right. Its mouth was open, its body had been ripped wide. Ants and vermin were already working on it, toiling endlessly. It had begun to stink.
But what happened? Labyrinth said.
He shook his head.
What could have done it?
There was a sound. We turned quickly. For a moment we saw nothing. Then a bush moved, and for the first time we made out its form. It must have been standing there watching us all the time. The creature was immense, thin and extended, with bright, intense eyes. To me, it looked something like a coyote, but much heavier. Its coat was matted and thick. Its muzzle hung partly open as it gazed at us silently, studying us, as if astonished to find us there.
The Wagner animal, Labyrinth said thickly. But it's changed. It's changed. I hardly recognize it.
The creature sniffed the air, its hackles up. Suddenly it moved back into the shadows, and a moment later it was gone. We stood for a while, not saying anything. At last Labyrinth stirred.
So, that's what it was, he said. I can hardly believe it. But why? What?
Adaptation, I said. When you toss an ordinary house cat out, it becomes wild. Or a dog.
Yes, he nodded. A dog becomes a wolf again to stay alive. The law of the forest. I should have expected it. It happens to everything.
I looked down at the corpse on the ground, and then around at the silent bushes. Adaptation. Or maybe something worse. An idea was forming in my mind, but I said nothing, not right away. I'd like to see some more of them, I said. Some of the others. Let's look around some more. He agreed. We began to poke slowly through the grass and weeds, pushing branches and foliage out of the way. I found a stick, but Labyrinth got down on his hands and knees, reaching and feeling, staring nearsightedly down. "Even children turn into beasts," I said. "You remember the wolf children of India? No one could believe they had been ordinary children." Labyrinth nodded. He was unhappy, and it was not hard to understand why. He had been wrong, mistaken in his original idea, and the consequences of it were just now beginning to become apparent to him. Music would survive as living creatures, but he had forgotten the lesson of the Garden of Eden, that once a thing has been fashioned, it begins to exist on its own, and thus ceases to be the property of its creator, to mold and direct as he wishes. God, watching man's development, must have felt the same sadness and the same humiliation as Labyrinth, to see his creatures alter and change to meet the needs of survival. That his musical creatures should survive could mean nothing to him anymore. For the very thing he had created them to prevent, the brutalization of beautiful things, was happening in them before his own eyes. Doc Labyrinth looked up at me suddenly, his face full of misery. He had ensured their survival, all right, but in doing so he had erased any meaning, any value in it. I tried to smile a little at him, but he promptly looked away again. "Don't worry so much about it," I said. "It wasn't much of a change for the Wagner animal. Wasn't it pretty much that way anyhow, rough and temperamental? Didn't it have a proclivity towards violence?" I broke off. Doc Labyrinth had leaped back, jerking his hand out of the grass. He clutched his wrist, shuddering with pain. "What is it?" I hurried over. Trembling, he held his little old hand out to me. "What is it? What happened?" I turned the hand over. All across the back of it were marks, red cuts that swelled even as I watched. He had been stung or bitten by something in the grass. I looked down, kicking the grass with my foot. There was a stir. A little golden ball rolled quickly away, back towards the bushes. It was covered with spines like a nettle.
"Catch it!" Labyrinth cried. "Quick!"
I went after it, holding out my handkerchief, trying to avoid the spines. The sphere rolled frantically, trying to get away, but finally I got it into the handkerchief. Labyrinth stared at the struggling handkerchief as I stood up.
"I can hardly believe it," he said. "We'd better go back to the house."
"What is it?"
"One of the Bach bugs. But it's changed."
We made our way back along the path toward the house, feeling our way through the darkness. I went first, pushing the branches aside, and Labyrinth followed behind, moody and withdrawn, rubbing his hand from time to time. We entered the yard and went up the back steps of the house onto the porch. Labyrinth unlocked the door and we went into the kitchen. He snapped on the light and hurried to the sink to bathe his hand. I took an empty fruit jar from the cupboard and carefully dropped the Bach bug into it. The golden ball rolled testily around as I clamped the lid on. I sat down at the table. Neither of us spoke, Labyrinth at the sink running cold water over his stung hand, I at the table, uncomfortably watching the golden ball in the fruit jar trying to find some way to escape. "Well," I said at last.
"There's no doubt," Labyrinth came over and sat down opposite me. "It's undergone some metamorphosis. It certainly didn't have poison spines to start with. You know, it's a good thing that I played my Noah role carefully."
"What do you mean?"
"I made them all neuter. They can't reproduce. There will be no second generation. When these die, that will be the end of it."
"I must say I'm glad you thought of that."
"I wonder," Labyrinth murmured. "I wonder how it would sound now, this way."
"What?"
"The sphere. The Bach bug. That's the real test, isn't it? I could put it back through the machine. We could see. Do you want to find out?"
"Whatever you say, Doc," I said. "It's up to you. But don't get your hopes up too far." He picked up the fruit jar carefully, and we walked downstairs, down the steep flights of steps to the cellar. I made out an immense column of dull metal rising up in the corner, by the laundry tubs. A strange feeling went through me. It was the preserving machine.
So this is it, I said. Yes, this is it.
Labyrinth turned the controls on and worked with them for a time. At last, he took the jar and held it over the hopper. He removed the lid carefully, and the bok bug dropped reluctantly from the jar into the machine. Labyrinth closed the hopper after it.
Here we go, he said.
He threw the control, and the machine began to operate. Labyrinth folded his arms, and we waited. Outside, the night came on, shutting out the light, squeezing it out of existence. At last, an indicator on the face of the machine blinked red. The doc turned the control to off, and we stood in silence, neither of us wanting to be the one who opened it.
Well, I said finally, which one of us is going to look?
Labyrinth stirred. He pushed the slot piece aside and reached into the machine. His fingers came out grasping a slim sheet, a score of music. He handed it to me.
This is the result, he said. We can go upstairs and play it.
We went back up to the music room. Labyrinth sat down before the grand piano and I passed him back the score. He opened it and studied it for a moment, his face blank, without expression. Then he began to play. I listened to the music. It was hideous. I have never heard anything like it. It was distorted, diabolical, without sense or meaning, except perhaps an alien, disconcerting meaning that should never have been there. I could believe only with the greatest effort that it had once been a Bach fugue, part of a most orderly and respected work.
That settles it, Labyrinth said.
He stood up, took the score in his hands, and tore it to shreds. As we made our way down the path to my car, I said, I guess the struggle for survival is a force bigger than any human ethos. It makes our precious morals and manners look a little thin. Labyrinth agreed.
Perhaps nothing can be done, then, to save those manners and morals.
Only time will tell, I said. Even though this method failed, some other may work. Something that we can't foresee or predict now may come along someday. I said good night and got into my car. It was pitch dark. Night had fallen completely. I switched on my headlights and moved off down the road, driving into the utter darkness. There were no other cars in sight anywhere. I was alone and very cold. At the corner, I stopped, slowing down to change gears. Something moved suddenly at the curb. Something by the base of a huge sycamore tree in the darkness. I peered out, trying to see what it was. At the base of the sycamore tree, a huge dun-colored beetle was building something, putting a bit of mud into place on a strange, awkward structure. I watched the beetle for a time, puzzled and curious, until at last it noticed me and stopped. The beetle turned abruptly and entered its building, snapping the door firmly shut behind it. I drove away.